would occasionally come back to me. I'd see the grimy rim, painted fresh with lilacs and fish, the maple runners creaking back and forth, some bald little thing wedged inside, wiggling. I'd see a face hovering over it going, you know, shh, shh. The thing is, I have no memory at all of my mother before the commune broke up. In my mind, it was always just Tamika and a constantly shifting amalgamate of teenagers and adults, legs in jeans, legs in skirts, and I admit, I wanted to bring her into focus, see her rocking a little baby I could imagine was me. But my mom never said much about my baby self. She didn't have any pictures, of course, and she once said with a snort that my first word was wah. She couldn't even tell me what she'd chosen when the commune did the vote for my name. Madeline's all your dad, she insisted. But I knew from stories that everybody wrote down the names they wanted and put them in a hat. For a while, I thought about that a lot, the names she might have liked, such as Winter or Juniper or Ark. I thought about those baby days and maybe names. Kennedy, I thought with longing, when I was doing my wolf project in eighth grade. Until it dawned on me at some point that maybe my mother wouldn't say, not because she'd wanted something else, but because she'd suggested nothing at all. And then I began to wonder who besides my dad had wanted Madeline. Who else had voted for that? I'm not saying I ever consciously wished there'd been someone else, and I'm not saying this thinking happened all at once, because it didn't. It came over me gradually, almost unremarkably, in a way that seemed to move on a separate plane from all the other events in my life. I can't attach to it anything that happened, to a year in school or a particular thing my mother did or didn't do, but once the thought was there, it didn't go away. The CEO's doing her accounts, she'd say, for instance, and my scalp would tighten like a cap above my ears. Or she'd dangle some decorative lure she was making in front of my nose while I was connecting dots in my workbook, and I'd have to lay my pencil down. I'd have to release that pencil like it was a match in a newly lit fire. Look up at her. Hush, she'd say to herself then, seeing the dark expression on my face. But not the plea, never the bald desire to be treated more gently. She'd whisper, "The professor's at work! Shh, everyone be quiet!" Or she'd knock the air between us with the hand she wasn't using for driving. She knocked the air and kept her eye on the highway. "Earth to Madeline! Did you hear what I said?" And before I knew what I was doing that day in the truck, before I could stop myself, I was croaking out, "Did I do okay?" "You mean..." I waited. Felt the truck's engine churning us down the road. Missing, churning again. She thought about it for a while before saying, "What happened probably would have happened whatever you'd done. If that's what you mean." I returned my head to the lip of the door, watched clouds swell over other clouds that might have been smoke. She tried again. "I'm not the judge of this one. You only say that because I'm not your kid," I remember thinking, rolling my forehead grease against the window, making it look like some wide, unidentifiable insect had flown against the glass. It's hard now to know how much of what I did and wanted in those years came from some version of that thought. What's the difference between what you want to believe and what you do? That's what I should have asked Patra. That's the question I wanted answered, but it didn't occur to me, or not in that way, until after we'd talked that day in the courthouse parking lot, until I was riding with my mother in the hot rumbling truck, and she was parking between two vans behind Our Lady. While my mom wrote a thank you note to tuck under the visor, I got down on my haunches in the gravel parking lot, my salad dress poofing around me, and started sifting through the little stones. Then my mom came up, said, "Okay," and we started back. As we walked along the highway shoulder, I uncurled my fingers and let the stones fall out. She didn't try to talk to me anymore. She let me dawdle and lag behind, dropping rocks as I went. She glanced back at me once at the turnoff to the lake, but by the time I reached the sumac trail, by the time our cabin chimney was visible again over treetops, she was out of sight. She was a rustling of sumac branches, leaves moving in a pulse as she passed underneath. And what's the difference between what you think and what you end up doing? That's what I should have asked Mr. Grierson in my letter. Mr. Grierson, who, even after Lily took back her accusation, was sentenced to 7 years based on the pictures and his courtroom confession. I read through his statements in the months after his sentence, which he served first in Seagoville, Texas, then in Elkton, Ohio. The Gardners, who'd been charged with manslaughter, were acquitted after 3 weeks on the grounds that they were protected by religious exemption. I didn't follow them after the Whitewood trial ended. After I said my piece in court, I went home with my mom in the borrowed truck, ate 3 peanut butter sandwiches in a row, went fishing for pike. Went fishing, got drunk for the first time, forgot. Their cabin sat empty across the lake for months, and I never went back. And I didn't stop to watch when the new owners set up their grill and badminton net the next summer. But I tracked Mr. Grierson around the country when he got out of jail, followed his little red flag from state to state, from Florida to Montana and back again. I watched him return to prison for violating the terms of his parole, get out again after another year, set up his shop in the marshes. By the time I wrote him my letter, by the time I was living in Minneapolis with Anne, I'd read his official statement about Lily several times. I thought about it, he'd said. He went on a few sentences farther down. I wanted to. And when she said that I had, I was like, yes. When all that stuff was found in my apartment, I pretended I'd never seen it before. I did lie about that. But when that girl Lily said what she said, I thought, all right. Okay, now my real life begins. Chapter 20. The view from my desk at the barge company in Minneapolis was a weathered concrete parking ramp. All day long I could see people puppeting out of their car windows, punching their tickets, waiting for the yellow arm to kick up. If I scooted my chair back from my desk and swiveled 180 degrees, I could also see a wedge of Mississippi between the ramp and a bank of willows. Egrets, brown foam, white buoys. After my first full year there, I was given my own cubicle and my own computer, so I could do what I wanted most of the time and no one bothered me. I could watch the egrets pluck fish from the river and the ferries of tourists head toward St. Paul. Or if I chose, I could look up things online while I input spreadsheets. Cases of high-altitude cerebral edema on Everest, or recent sales at the treasure chest. Though I was just a temp, I was at Manico Barge long enough to get a shelf for my lunch and a hook for my jacket in the break room. I was there long enough to become the go-to person for dealing with the distressed wives of deckhands. To everyone's surprise, I was good at calming these women down when they called. I'd say things like, "Don't worry, your husband will be home again soon." I'd promise, "He'll get to shore in Oquawka and call tonight." I'd say this even when I knew he wouldn't get to shore for another day, and when he did, he'd probably hit the bar before calling anyone. Still, the wives knew me by name and asked for me every time. I kept track of the ages of all their kids, the names of their dogs, the names of their babysitters. I was used to them calling at the end of the day, so when my phone rang at 4 one afternoon, one early spring, my second year there, I thought at first it was just another worried wife. Right away, I could hear irritation in the woman's voice, the way her vowels squished up around her attempt to sound friendly. "I'm so sorry to bother you at work," she said primly. "Is this a bad time for you?" So then I was pretty sure it wasn't a wife, but a regular wrong number. I was about to hang up on her. I was about to hang up and straighten my pantyhose and get my last cup of coffee when I heard whoever it was draw in a sharp breath. "I'm very sorry to bother you," the woman said again. "Then please don't hang up." So even before she said she was from Loose River, even before she explained who she was, I recognized something about the way she spoke, about the way she apologized as a means to express disapproval. That was a Loose River thing to do. When I didn't say anything, and didn't hang up either, the woman went on. She said she'd found my number by calling my old job in Duluth. She said she'd tracked down my old landlord, and that he told her the name of the temp agency where he thought I'd gone to work. But it took some doing before they gave out the name of the barge company. "I'd been pretty hard to find," she said. She hadn't wanted to meddle this way, she went on, but she wasn't sure how else to go about this. "I'm calling on behalf of your mom," she said, then paused. "She's stopped coming to church. She hasn't been to church for a few months, so I went out to visit her." I waited. "The place is getting a bit run down?" I cleared my throat. "The cabin?" "Actually, the cabin roof was taken off in a storm last year. Or that's what she said."
"The roof came off?"
I think she wintered in the shed. She moved a stove out there."
"To the shed? It's not insulated."
"She's tried insulating the walls with leaves and clothes. Newspapers."
I couldn't imagine it, and then I could. "Okay."
"She nicked a finger chopping wood. I don't think she can see too good anymore."
"Who is this again?"
I asked, feeling not sick, but a slow pounding in my head. "Liz Lundgren, I go to Our Lady with your mom."
"Ms. Lundgren?"
I stood up. I started pacing the length of the phone cord, chewing my lip, looking over the cubicle wall and out the window, where the brown water of the Mississippi was sliming steadily by on its way to the Gulf. That's when something broke loose in my mind, drifted out. "Life science," I said. There was a pause. "Yes, a million years ago, yes." Liz Lundgren bit down on something in her mouth, and I could hear relief flooding in her voice when she spoke again. "I filled in before I retired, at the high school. Yes, that's me. Listen, Linda, I'm not trying to meddle. I don't want to cause trouble, but I think I could arrange a call. I mean, I think she'd like me to arrange a call." Heaven and hell are ways of thinking. Death is the false belief that anything could ever end. For Christian Scientists, there is only the next phase, which as far as I can tell is the same as this one, only maybe you see it differently. This much I got from the church service I went to one Wednesday night that spring. I went not long after Ms. Lundgren's call, on an evening after a happy hour that involved two vodka tonics and a couple of scummy warm beers. I paced the sidewalk outside the big church doors for a few minutes, pretty drunk, pretending I was going somewhere else, before I finally pushed through the doors and went in. I walked as straight as possible to the nearest pew, sat down like I was in school again, looking around without moving my head. Whatever I'd been expecting to find inside, whatever I'd been avoiding for more than a dozen years, it wasn't what I saw that night. There were maybe 8 people in a cream-colored sanctuary, which smelled like Pine Sol, and whose white carpet was raked with deep vacuum lines between the pews.
Everything was painted white and cream, white and beige, white and pink. The plaster walls and wooden pews and simple lectern in front. The sermon, or whatever it was called, began. A smooth-faced elderly man leaned over the lectern and read from the Bible, and science and health with key to the scriptures. Occasionally, he stopped to take sips of water from a glass that caught tiny panels of light and disco-balled them around the room. I must have dozed off because the next thing I knew, someone two pews in front of me was speaking into a cordless mic. She was an old lady with a silver bun, and she held that big mic in her tiny hand like an ice cream cone, mumming it with her lips, fuzzing the room with static. She explained she'd been healed of a toothache by being nicer to a neighbor who'd complained about her yard. Her toothache had been a false belief in mortal mind that had tricked her into feeling pain. But Mary Baker Eddy taught us, through Jesus, to love thy neighbor. She said she'd left a pot of tulips on her neighbor's driveway, and the toothache disappeared. A teenage kid went next. He wore polished leather shoes and a crisp white linen shirt rolled up to the elbows. He reminded me of the forensics boys from high school at first, except he had powerful tendons in his forearms and faint stubble, like someone who worked outside. He knew exactly how far to hold the microphone from his lips. When he paused, he smoothed a wrinkle in his pants very close to his crotch. He told a long, winding story about a test in school he hadn't been able to study for, an AP exam, and then, thanking our beloved founder, Mary Baker Eddy, he explained how he'd done well anyhow. After that, it was quiet for a long time. The pews creaked like branches, and my head began to ache. The night birds started to trill outside, and I longed to slouch down in my seat, lay my head against the cool wood of the pew. But I didn't. I made myself sit straighter, pay attention. The last person to stand and take the microphone was another old woman. She said she'd been healed of the belief that her husband had died when she'd read this week's lesson. She smiled brightly and touched her snow-white hair with one hand as she spoke. She said she had given in to the false assumption that her husband was madder, and for months she'd been unable to part with any of his things, his shoes or books or soap. But she finally poured the last of his Old Spice shampoo down the toilet when it came to her that we are reflections of life. Harold, too. There was no death for any of us, ever. I remember exactly how she put the next part because my palms started to sweat. Harold's fine. Harold's fine always. It's not what you do, but what you think that matters. Mary Baker Eddy tells us heaven and hell are ways of thinking. We need to know the truth of that. Pray to understand that death is just the false belief that anything could ever end. There's no going anywhere for any of us, not in reality. There's only changing how you see things. I was on my way out afterward when the woman with the snowy hair stopped me at the door. Up close, her eyes were a filmy, glistening blue. She was wearing a beige linen dress and a diamond on her ring finger. "Would you like to sign in as a guest? We're so happy to have you." She'd gotten a clipboard and a flyer from somewhere and was handing them to me. "Excuse me," I said. As I moved around her, I could smell the peppermint on her breath, the lilac perfume on her wrists, the chemical detergent on her dress. She smelled elaborately and intimately produced, scented with a whole life's worth of good intentions. She must have been 80 years old at least, but there was something youthful in her face, enviably untroubled. I paused to study her more closely, despite myself. I wanted to hear more about the husband, Harold, and his shampoo. She must have seen my hesitation.
"Are you new to the church?"
She lifted the pen attached by a bald chain to her clipboard.
"Yes,"
I said. Then I instantly regretted it. She looked so avid. "I mean, this church," I clarified before stepping into the night. "I'm not from around here." This was probably around mid-April. I remember a glint of green had already started showing on the willows by the river. Not long after the leaves on the sidewalk, trees burst out, a wallop of bright green everywhere you looked. And I went to the credit union after work one day to see how much money I'd saved. Afterward, I went to the hardware store to buy a screw for the doorknob Anne had been complaining about for months. While I was fixing that, since I was already on my knees in the bathroom, I decided to repair the leaky bathtub faucet. I pinched a crimped nest of hair from the drain with two fingers and put a new roll of toilet paper in the dispenser and gathered up all the towels to wash at the laundromat. I left the towels in the dryer until they were so hot they burned my arms when I hugged them out. Then I folded them into warm, leaning towers and carried them home with my chin resting on top. On my last day in town, I went to Rom's apartment at dawn. Wind was battering the loose shingles on the old Victorian turrets. I used his key to get in, left my stuff by the door in a heap, and crept into his bed with my shoes and jacket on. He didn't wake up as he pulled me into him, as he sunk his face in my hair. "Goodbye," I said. I wanted him to wake up. I wanted to walk around on my hands and knees one more time, collared. But he barely stirred. He nestled his cock between my legs and fell into a deeper sleep. The clock on his shelf shone its red numbers at me. Morning came in a single gray bar through a slat in the shades. I started to get hot in his arms and my jacket, sweaty. After a while, I looked at the clock again and realized if I didn't hurry, I was going to miss my bus. I was going to miss my transfer to the Greyhound station across town and my ride up to Whitewood, where my mother would be waiting with Ms. Lundgren at the Burger King near the bus terminal. She hadn't sounded especially happy to hear from me when I finally called. It had been 2 years since I'd spoken to her last, since my dad died, and all she said after a few stiff hellos was, "It's looking like it's about time to sell some of the land." As the sun came through the high window in Rom's basement apartment, I wiggled my way out of his sleeping arms. I pulled out from under his grasp, and that's when he woke up at last, when he felt me leaving.
"What are you doing here?"
"I'm not here."
"Who's this in my bed then, Girl Scout?"
"Some fantasy of yours."
"Fuck you."
I could feel his mouth smiling into my scalp.
"Okay," I whispered, pulling away. "Try."
As I was sliding out of his arms, he pulled me back. He squeezed me tighter. I could feel my own ribs in his arms, even through my canvas jacket, the bones pushing back against his weight. I liked that. I liked how the more I fought, the more tightly he held on. I squirmed free of his grasp, half sitting up. I twisted around, but before I could swing my legs to the floor, he grabbed me around the waist and pulled me back down. I wanted more. I wanted more. He started to pull open the buttons on my coat, and on impulse, I bent my leg and kneed him in the chest, hard, so he started coughing. Sitting back on his haunches in his boxers, he looked confused. I felt the chill of that moment hit my skin like a splash of water. Morning light caught the pores on his face so it looked rough as sandpaper.
"What's going on?"
he asked, now fully awake. His thin white shoulders looked rectangular against the wall. He'd taken the stud from his tongue so his words had no click to them. They sounded softer than usual, simpler, wetter.
"Nothing."
That's when he saw my big backpack at the door.
"What is this? What are you doing?"
"I came to say goodbye."
"Goodbye?"
He blinked at me.
"You're going back to ass crack nowheresville."
"Right now." I pushed off the bed, straightened my jacket. I went to the door where my backpack was waiting. And as I hoisted it to my shoulder, I turned back to look at him, huddled in bed across the room. He had one hand on his left eye, pirate style.
You're going to a place where the wolves eat the fucking dogs. I shook my head. That was Alaska, an anecdote. It's been, what, like almost 2 years? I talked to my mom. It's planned. We've been happy, right? What is it you think you did that you can't be happy? Happy, 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 I said. Happy! He flipped the word over, made it innocent again. Don't be a baby, I sneered. He must have seen something ugly in my expression because he found his shirt and plunged his head inside it. For an instant, his face was a white cotton mask, blank indentations for mouth and eyes. Then his head was free and he was zipping up his pants. He was getting his cell phone from the dresser, and I found I could speak to him as myself again, more deliberately. Don't be childish about it. I came to say goodbye, okay? I came to say thank you and goodbye. I'm being childish. Listen, listen. He took a few steps forward, his t-shirt catching on the hill of his belly. Do you remember when you told me about that little kid? That little kid. The thought of Paul went like a breeze right through me. I put up a hand to stop him from going on. I didn't tell you about any kid. I mean you, Girl Scout. The easiest prey in the world. House of old hippies, girl left behind. That's not what I said. That's not what it was like. The fool. No. Walking off a cliff every time you take a step. Poor little girl with, like, no shoes and an empty belly. Who's taking care of you? That's not how it was. I was fine. I was fine. What kid did you mean? I sucked in a breath. Nobody. He died. Who did? Nobody. He's fine. As I said it, I reached into my pocket, found the smoothness of the Swiss Army knife, and thrust it out toward Rom. He stepped back. What the... It was the one he'd given me for Christmas, shiny and red. All the blades were tucked in, but maybe he didn't see that. Maybe the memory of me kneeing him in the chest was too recent. He laced his fingers over the top of his head, and I could see the scraggly hair under his arms through the gaping sleeves of his t-shirt. After a moment, he let his arms fall to his sides. Whatever. Keep it. He shook out a breath. He slid his hands into his pockets. Keep it, fool scout. I found myself thinking of that church lady as I waited to board the bus. Heaven and hell are ways of thinking. Death is just the false belief that anything could ever end. It lingered till the last minute in the waiting area near a blind homeless man on his cardboard island. Reluctant to get on, reluctant to climb the steep stairs onto the coach. It's not what you do, but what you think that matters. I didn't want to board. But once I was on the bus, I saw the windows were unexpectedly tall and wide, tinted against the bright morning sun, and I had the two-seat row to myself. The coach slid effortlessly through city traffic. It glided around the clover leaf and onto the highway, passing even the semis going downhill. As the bus angled north, as we left the city behind, I watched the leaves on the trees through the window go from deep green to pale mint to nothing. I watched snow appear in banks on the roadsides again, and somewhere along the way, despite myself, I started to feel a sleepy, sweet, intoxicating calm. Perhaps it had to do with the speed and height of the bus, the feeling of soaring over the highway and going fast enough to kill somebody. Speed is one kind of magic. I've always felt that. But the wash of calm also came from seeing the lakes frozen over again at the shorelines. Patches of bluish snow on the ground, black fields gone white and empty. After a few hours, I started seeing fish huts rise up from the lakes in compact, exact little cities. I could see crows circling the air above, looking for scraps. It came to me near Bemidji. We'd slowed for some teenagers crossing the road at a light, girls in huge puffy coats. How strange it must have been to move to a frigid place like this for the first time in middle age, to arrive from California in winter. But to him, it must have seemed so forgiving at first. All the teenagers, all the girls, clomping through town in boots, in heavy wool sweaters and jackets. Everything up till then wouldn't count. All those pictures wouldn't count. It's not what you think, but what you do that matters. I waited for Whitewood to appear over the next ridge, and the next, and then a new thought came to me. It came all at once. Those pictures had been gift-wrapped, purposely left below the sink for someone to find. To find and find out that he'd wanted it to happen. It started to snow. Before we reached Whitewood, snow was blanketing the road. It happened so fast it was startling. Blacktop, yellow lines, median, all gone within minutes. I felt the disconnected parts of my brain snap piece by piece into place as fresh wet flakes flashed down outside. As the bus fishtailed and everybody gasped, as the wheels found traction and we barreled on. Chapter 21. No, I didn't think to call 911. I admitted this on the stand. It did not occur to me to use the cell phone or go to my parents' house or to take the bike into town. I didn't think about how it would have been faster to flag someone down on the road or go to the information booth at the National Forest campground. I said, I didn't really have a plan. I said, I don't really know what I was thinking. When I told Patra I'd get the Tylenol that morning, I testified, I just put on my shoes and opened the door. What I didn't say on the stand was that when I looked back at her from the doorway, Patra had been mouthing something. It had been strange to see, like she was yelling without sound, like her whole face was contorting around each word, going, thank you, going, help us. Help us, please. Did she think I would understand? I remember closing the door very gently, listening for the latch. Did she think I would do for her what she couldn't do herself? Having come this far, having accumulated everything that mattered to her at all through a series of little irrevocable choices? I remember squinting into the hot morning, letting go of the knob. I remember lifting the rock in the woods, finding the money in its damp roll, taking off at a sprint. High summer sun hit from directly above. No breeze, no birds or clouds. Two tall walls of green rose up on either side of the highway. I don't remember getting tired, but I do remember my chest starting to burn. And just as it did, a helicopter swooped directly overhead. It was one of those Forest Service copters fitted with tanks and buckets, painted bright red. It churned the highest branches of the trees, and I stopped for a moment in the middle of the highway to look up at it. Was there a fire? I remember wondering, but only briefly because the roar of the copter skimmed away all thoughts. Its wind whipped the loose strands of my hair and rippled like a spook through my t-shirt. By the time it was gone, I was walking along. My heart was still thudding, but some of the urgency had drained from my limbs. It was much easier being outdoors again, in the woods, in the sun. I felt a little lighter as my t-shirt settled back over my sweaty skin. I felt chilled. Let me be clear about something. The woods of my childhood are not the same woods I see today. When I was small, another name for Still Lake was Swamp Lake, because during dry years, cattails ate up the shore, and the lily pads were so thick they looked like solid ground. In wet years, the lake flooded its banks, and we could almost dock the canoes at the cabin steps. Now, The Association of Homeowners has widened the channel between Still and Mill Lakes, ensuring unvarying water levels year in, year out. There are 12 summer homes around the perimeter, not log houses so much as mini chalets, with skylights and multiple decks and moored pontoon boats on beaches. In summer, it's a suburb. Most of the lakeshore pines have been cut down for sunbathers and flower beds. The water is crowded with little kids horsing around, with teenagers in black inner tubes, bouncing behind bow riders. Dads in cabin cruisers skulk inlets and bays, hoping for some hoary walleye. Sometimes when I sit with my mother outside the rehab cabin on what's left of our lot, I try to remember how the woods looked to me when I was younger. I know better than to be wistful. It was never magical to me. I was never so young, nor so proprietary as to see it like that. Year by year, the woods just kept unfurling and blooming and drying up, and its constant flux implied meanings half revealed, half withheld. Mysteries, yes, but mysteries made rote by change itself. The woods covering and recovering its tracks. When I was 8 or 9, I used to go down to the shore and fill coffee cans with toads the size of dimes. I called these zoos. My mother would want me to pray before I went to sleep, and so I said the same prayer every night. Dear God, please help Mom, Dad, Tamika, Abe, Doctor, Jasper, Quiet, and all the animals in all the zoos to not be too bored and not too lonely. Not too was my mantra. I wanted very badly to keep the toads. I liked their many faces, their highly structural eyes especially. But I worried about what I was keeping them from. After a few nights of swelling guilt, I would empty out the coffee cans in a speckled alder bush, and as the toads popped away on their tiny legs, I felt the power of the woods very keenly. I felt the way it chastised and corrected me, the way it always seemed to say, "See?" Here's what I passed that day as I walked into town. First, the familiar spray-painted sign propped on the roadside, the one that promised liquor and gas. For years, Katerina the Communist ran that old place, selling bait and beer at a discount, vodka and gasoline at a premium. Katerina was 50, my whole life, a second-generation Czech from Iowa with the same hooded eyes as my toads. She sold my dad's blow-down wood and twined bundles, and my mother's handmade lures reconfigured as earrings. As I got older, it dawned on me that she pitied us. Once she gave me a pair of Adidas tennis shoes that had belonged to her niece, saying, "God damn it, Linda," when I wouldn't take them at first, saying, "A high schooler does not wear hiking boots to school, period, okay? Okay?" For years, those were my very best shoes. I was wearing them that day. I knew she kept a couple of dusty boxes of Band-Aids on the shelf, perhaps a bottle or two of Tylenol as well, but I skipped liquor and gas that hot Monday morning, dreading Katerina's bustle and chewed nails, her greasy pity, which somehow infected me with her bad looks, which always made me feel as fetid and sweaty as she was. The next thing I passed was the stop sign, which locals only occasionally obeyed, followed by the three bars and the three churches. On Monday morning, all six buildings were closed, the bar on one side of the road, the churches on the other. There were overturned empties on the grass next to Our Lady's wooden crucifix, Sunday bulletins blown into a paper mesh against the chain-link fence at the Hare and Fox. "All are welcome in God's house," they said again and again. Then came the ice rink, with its shell-like hulk, its aluminum siding and flat asphalt roof. It was the biggest building in town by far. Weekdays in the summer it was packed with figure skaters and hockey players competing for ice time. When I passed the rink, I saw that the Zamboni had chased them all outdoors. They hobbled around the parking lot in their skate guards, The boys hoping to be the target of the girls' vitriol, the girls in turn hoping to be the target of chucked ice shavings. Past the rink, were the downtown shops with their old-timey facades and crumbling brick, their storefronts built during the timber boom last century, bank, bait-and-tackle, hardware. Grandmas and veterans were already ordering their lunches at the diner, their white bread sandwiches and wild rice soup. From the sun-bleached side of the building, the three-painted walleye reared above a street lamp and waved. Closer to the river were the charred remains of the old timber mill, now so overgrown with summer trees and weeds you could hardly see it. Farther down Main, near the interstate, was the strip mall Pine Alley. After that, Whitewood was 21 miles east. In another 120 miles, Duluth. Then the lift bridge, the anchored tall ships, Lake Superior itself. I thought of it briefly, as I walked past the Pine Alley shops, as I fingered the four dirty tens in my pocket. It was almost longing, I felt. Superior, with its 31,000 square miles of water and its 39-degree temperature year-round, with its sunken SS Edmund Fitzgerald and its piles of spilled taconite, and its unrecovered bodies preserved face down in silt in orange life jackets. The drugstore was in the strip mall. I pushed the door and went in. The air conditioning sent a fast shudder up and down my skin. All the items on the shelves, the indecipherable bottles of vitamins, the cough syrups, were cold to the touch. I must have been extremely sweaty when I came in the door, because after a minute or two my fingers were a splotchy white, and I had to wiggle them to draw blood back. In the back of the store, a sunburnt dad in flip-flops and bathing trunks was trying to pry the handle of a broom from a toddler's mouth. He nodded at me, holding the baby's hand up in the air as if it were a prop. "Do you need something in particular?" a girl's voice asked. I looked up and saw it was Sarah the ice skater. She was wearing a green smock and nibbling a red straw from the Frosties next door. I was too surprised to respond. Wasn't it summer? Didn't that mean Sarah had all day every day to work on her triples? Weren't the Olympics just a year away? Then I remembered that Sarah's double axle had dried up last spring during Upper Great Lakes. Every time she went up in the air, people said she had the determined terror of a suicide. She'd look like she was throwing herself off a ledge. "You need something special?" Sarah asked, approaching me, teething her straw. The baby in the back of the store was going, "Ga, ga, ga." "No." As I scanned the bottles in the wellness and nutrition aisle, I felt the distance between us close. There was a medication called Human Health that claimed to close your pores. There was a multivitamin called Iggy that you squeezed into your nose with an eyedropper. I didn't see any Tylenol, but low-dose aspirin, I read, was for thinning the blood, as well as for preventing fever, stroke, pregnancy loss, pain, and possibly, promising studies showed, cancer. Sarah asked, "Is it your time of the month?" "No." "You hungover?" "No." She watched me read the back of a clattery bottle of multivitamins. "You anemic?" She sucked again from her straw, never taking her eyes off me. "Are you, like, malnourished or something?" "I've got a headache, I searched for the word. "A migraine." "Did you fall?" She lowered her voice. "Did somebody hit you?" "I mean a stomach ache or a fever, possibly." She took a step back. "A fever? You better call Dr. Lord." "You mean Lorne?" "There's a D on the end of it, I'm pretty sure." I was about to take issue at this point when the baby in the back of the store let out a wail. Something about that sound made me step forward and touch Sarah's wrist briefly. "It might be a high fever. Is there something here for very high fevers?" Though I'd barely touched her, I swear I could see Sarah's arm twitch. She narrowed her dark eyes. Oh, God, you're contagious, aren't you? I've got a late-night shift. I've got to work late. Stay away from me. Don't get too close. I'm serious.
I took a step forward. I'm not that sick. She shuffled away gracefully on her skating feet and stood with her back against a wall of tampons.
Don't come near me, okay? Just take what you need and put it on the counter.
At a loss, I grabbed the bottle of low-dose aspirin for $3.99 and put it in my basket. Then, on impulse, I added 2 pixie sticks, a bag of tropical Skittles, and an atomic fireball. I set everything on the counter by the cash register, and Sarah motioned for me to back up while she came around, found a pair of green gardening gloves with a price tag still on, wedged her hand in one of them, and used that to ring everything up. It came to $5.39, and when I set one of my soiled tens on the counter, smeared with dirt and moss, folded at the corners, Sarah closed her eyes, as if her worst fears were confirmed, as if visible disease clung to that bill in the form of actual mud, and she told me to take what I needed. She'd pay, whatever, just go. As I left, I saw the toddler in the back of the store had put a padded bra over his mouth like a bandit. He waved at me. Once I was out on the street again, the real heat of the day slammed into me. I ambled up the hill toward the high school, sucking one of my Maui Punch pixie sticks, then down past the junior high working on the tropical Skittles. I went past City Hall twice, 3 times, thinking somebody might stop and ask me why I was loitering on the steps. I sat for a minute on the curb, where I saw an old lighter in the gutter, like it just wanted my fingers on it. And I lit the second of my pixie sticks on fire. It burned slowly, smoking and dripping red goo on the sidewalk. When nobody stopped me for arson or loitering, I stamped out the oozing straw and went to the hardware store. It occurred to me that I might see my dad there. He sometimes went in for nails and fishing line. But Mr. Ling, the owner, was alone, dozing with a gopher's cap over his eyes. Next, I went into the grocery store. It was empty except for Mr. Korhonen, who was reading the paper on the counter and didn't look up. Strangely, the door didn't make a sound when I entered or left. Each time it caught a pocket of air and never quite closed. I poked my head in the diner, but Santa Anna, my old boss, was on vacation. She'd gone to the Laurel and Hardy Festival in Toronto and gotten her sister to fill in. "She'll be back in a week or so," the sister said, pushing long bangs from her eyes and pouring coffee for an old lady doing a crossword puzzle. Down the road, I saw that the door to Unified Spirit was now open, and I went in, thinking I might see my mom at one of her many meetings. At the very least, I thought I might see Pastor Benson, tending his rabbits in one of the cages in his office, or the secretary folding Sunday bulletins in the multipurpose room in the back, but no one seemed to be there at all. The wooden pews in the sanctuary were set up in such a way that they blocked any reasonable route to the altar. I wound this way and that, moving through those maze-like pews, and in grim triumph arrived at the altar, sucking on my atomic fireball. My mouth burned, and at the same time felt finely and delicately needled through with shards of sugar. By then, about 24 hours had passed since we'd left Duluth. By then I later learned Paul had an hour before he slipped into a coma, another 4 hours before cardiac arrest. Dear God, I thought when I got to the cross, though I knew it was a rinky-dink faith I possessed of less use even than superstition. Dear God, please help Mom, Dad, Tamika, Abe, Jasper, Dr. Quiet, and Paul. To be not too bored and not too lonely. Not too. It was the only prayer I knew. As the heat from the atomic fireball filled my mouth, seeming to swell and lap at my tongue, seeming to enlarge the space inside me that could be burned, I thought of Patra. Deliberately then, letting my mind return to her bit by bit. I thought about Patra with all that pancake in her mouth, I thought about Patra going to the hospital to give birth to Paul, of her hand tapping out the beat of her heart on my thigh. And when I thought of all that, I almost believed that by buying the aspirin and making no fuss, I had done something to please her. My eyes watered from the heat in my mouth. Relief came over me just that quick. I'd done exactly what Patra had asked, and no more, so it felt almost heroic then, valiant in its way. How little I'd accomplished. I went up to the offering box on the altar and left the grubby tens with their folded black corners. At the last minute, I took off Patra's headband and left that as well, as a second thought, knowing the ache had settled in too deeply to dissipate any time soon. Then I wound my way through the pews and started back. And here's how I remember the woods of my childhood, every tree, even the pines planted in strict rows by the Forest Service years ago, seemed different. One with sap seeping out in blisters in the heat, another with a branch knocked down, leaving a gnome-like face in the wood. The woods were a kind of nursery for not thinking, for just seeing and walking along. I liked running my eyes over details, over twigs and pine needles, over roadkill with intestines like spilled baggage on the asphalt. There were certain things I knew about the woods. But always, too, there were things I was sure I'd never seen before in my life. A crow fighting with a snapping turtle over a fast food bag on the shoulder, for instance. Or a carpenter ant appearing from out of nowhere on my wrist, dragging a small green caterpillar up my arm like a prize. Or this. Halfway back to the gardener house, a car passed me by. Then 100 feet ahead it stopped and began to back up. By that time the sun was much lower in the sky. A woman in a white sun visor was driving, craning her neck around, but it was the man in the passenger seat who rolled his window down and spoke to me. In the back of the car sat two little kids, a boy and a girl, staring out. "Hey," the man said. "Everything okay?" Their license plate said Illinois, Land of Lincoln. I kept going. The car, a station wagon with a canoe lashed to the roof, slowly followed along as I walked, like one of those dogs you can't get rid of. The man had furry eyebrows. "We're not trying to be creepy," he said. "And you're right to be wary, of course, but I think..." The car drove over a fallen branch, which cracked very slowly and loudly. The man went on, "I can't help but think you look like you could use a ride somewhere." "Do you need a ride somewhere? The map says it's woods for 50 miles in this direction, just lakes and woods." He held the map out the window to show me, as if I didn't know this already, as if this was news to me. But he was watching my face very closely. "Okay," I said finally. Late afternoon was settling in around us. The bottle of aspirin was still in my hand. I felt calm, delivered. "It's not far," I promised. In the back seat, the little kids in their shorts and T-shirts helped me buckle my seatbelt. I had to direct the car. I had to say "slow down" at the turnoff to Still Lake, and then point the way in the shadows toward the narrow road that led to the gardener cabin. The visored woman was a good driver, and she took it easy on the gravel roads. The woods passed by languidly, the branches a blue-green slurry through the windows. I wondered how long I could keep the woman driving. She was very trusting, I could tell. I had the feeling I could point down any backwoods road, any rutted path, no matter how remote, and she'd go where I said. When I found myself enjoying this thought, it felt like a betrayal of something, though I wasn't sure what, so I urged the careful woman driver forward. I tried to warn her of bumps in the road, of future dangers. Sometimes it's hard to see deer. You gotta watch out if you're driving at dusk. Keep that in mind for later. There's no streetlights or anything. The woman gave me a little smile in the rearview mirror, like, "I know." The man was into small talk, but not like Leo, who liked facts, or my dad, who only did baseball, weather, and fish. He asked me where I was going. I said, home, which I guess sounded about right to him, because he left it at that, and started telling me about their campsite up near Turquoise Lake. Ever been there? I couldn't help rolling my eyes a million times. Any tips? I thought about it. There's a bald eagle's nest on the North Shore. One of the little kids, the girl, said with all eagerness, "Cool!" She had out a notebook and she wrote it down. Eagle's nest. At the top of that page it said plans, and next to that was a second list for memories. Here's what she'd written down under that. Dead deer on the road. Girl who looks like a boy. Doesn't know how to use a seatbelt. S-E-A-T, I told her. She made the correction, rubbing at her paper with the eraser. The father up front said, "We'd love to see a bald eagle." The mother said, "We've seen some hawks, but not any eagles. That would be great." I almost told them then, "There's something wrong with Paul." I almost said it. I think I need some help. But I didn't, because I knew they would help, and I didn't want Patra squinting at them through the front door in her t-shirt, her panties exposed, or Leo shooing this other father away with a sweaty handshake. I didn't want to see Patra shushed by Leo, sent back inside, or Leo tucking in his shirt and blinking his bloodshot eyes as he explained the way back to the highway. And I knew that if I somehow got this visored woman inside, if I somehow got her past Leo and into Paul's room, it would mean the end of Janet and Europa for good, the end of everything worthwhile. So I had the woman take the slow way around the lake, going down the one-lane logging road that was almost never used, that was overgrown with shrubs and young aspen. I had her take the boat access road to the shore and double back. As she drove, I could see the woman watching me very closely in the rearview mirror. She was driving and watching me both, but I broke her gaze and looked down at my lap. Beside me, the boy reached out and touched Paul's aspirin bottle. "What's that you got in your hand?" "I got a headache," I said. Though I no longer did, it was gone. We were going so slowly and the woods were so shaded and dark, it seemed the trees, not the car, were moving. They were sliding past the windows mechanically. And it was the car that seemed fragile and hesitant. Then the gardener cabin appeared. Car in the driveway, front shades closed, white cat peeping out one window. "Oh!" the woman driver exclaimed, surprised, plainly relieved to have reached a real destination. She rolled down her window to get a better look. "What a nice little house, just hidden away back here." I could see the little girl writing it down. Cottage. She wrote it down carefully. Deep in the woods. At some point, not long after that summer ended, the woods started to seem different to me, for good. Let me be clear, this feeling started long before the 20 acres on the east shore of Still Lake was subdivided and subdivided again by developers from the cities. It started long before the channel was widened between our lake and the next, before the aspens and pines were cleared and all the new houses built. Those were only the most obvious changes. What I'm talking about is something else. I remember watching the wind scuttling through a branch near the beginning of 10th grade and thinking I could see the Earth's orbit setting up a chain reaction of weather that made the blowing branch inevitable. I looked up at the foliage and saw electrons from a not-so-distant and not-so-spectacular star turning carbon dioxide into a yellow-green leaf. Abe died later that fall, and as I dug a hole for him beneath the pines, I started to think about What would happen if we never found humans?